Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, and also answers to your questions via email and phone. I'll be giving out those numbers in just a moment, but before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, you all know from experience, at least if you're a regular listener, that I will sometimes venture into the political arena when I think it is going to have a profound effect on healthcare. And so this particular election has a proposition on it that I think we all need to talk about a little bit. And so I have a guest here on the program that I'm going to introduce. And let me welcome Dr. Donaldo Hernandez. Don, have we got you there?
You do. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for agreeing to come on the program.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Hernandez is the trustee to the CMA. He's very involved in California medical politics. And I've asked Don here to talk with us about Proposition 46. So, Don, would you just tell us a little bit about Proposition 46, what it is and what its implications are for healthcare in California?
Absolutely. Proposition 46 is an initiative that will be on the November 4th ballot, specifically earmarked to increase the cap on medical malpractice lawsuits, and as a cofactor in that, drug testing of physicians and also requiring healthcare practitioners to consult the state prescription drug database, or the CURES database, as it's been come to know. What this basically is means by which trial attorneys have sought to increase the state's caps on damages assessed on medical negligence lawsuits. The current cap is $250,000, and what they're seeking is to increase it to well over $1.3 million. And how they've gotten about making that seem more palatable to the voters, given the fiscal and financial impact that will have on the state and individual families in California, is by surrounding it around requirements for drug and alcohol testing physicians. But the major part of the initiative and the major point of the initiative is the increase in the damages assessed in medical negligence lawsuits.
Now, this is the so-called pain and suffering part, right?
People,
there's something that many people have not been involved in a medical malpractice lawsuit wouldn't know. Is that there's punitive damages, which is punishment, and there is financial reimbursement for any financial loss, and also future financial losses, such as loss of income or requirements for future medical services. But then there's this sort of nebulous category called pain and suffering, which, well, I guess it depends on how sorry you feel for the person, but it is sort of a lottery when it comes to a lawsuit. And in states where there isn't a cap on pain and suffering, the malpractice payments that doctors have to pay to cover themselves against financial ruin are much, much higher. We're talking three or four-fold, aren't we?
Absolutely. As $100,000 or more per year just to practice medicine in some of those localities.
Yeah.
In fact, there are some localities within the United States where several counties, several areas, I mean, particularly New York State is often cited as an example of this, where whole counties don't even have obstetricians and gynecologists to provide services for them because the expense of the malpractice aspects of them conducting their business is prohibitive. They can't do it. They can't make their overhead. They can't make their payments based upon the expense of the liability insurance.
And in those circumstances, of course, that really affects access for patients. Could something like that happen here in California?
I think that's the biggest fear that I have about this, is that it would sharply curtail access, particularly at a time in the state where the effects of the Affordable Care Act are still being weighed. We're still trying to find out the overall effects of the Affordable Care Act and how health care is going to be delivered in California is going to occur. Now you impose this burden of increased malpractice premiums on top of that. I fear that a lot of physician practices, particularly practices that are attuned to the more poor, the folks that have had access problems to begin with prior to the Affordable Care Act, how they are going to have physicians that and providers even able to provide care for those groups and those people that require care.
Right,
like probably more than anybody else in the state, to be honest.
Well, I'm thinking about Watsonville and South County, because there are a large Hispanic population that really functions on a cash basis, and I'm well acquainted with the doctors who serve that community, and they're all small one and two doctor shops. The large multi-specialty groups aren't really interested in seeing these patients, or at least historically haven't been, and also are a somewhat user-unfriendly environment for that group. So I do think that's something that we need to think about. Will community clinics also be affected by this change?
That's true. They will be. Planned Parenthood has come out in opposition to 46. Several of the smaller clinics that provide care in the rural areas of the state have come out in opposition to this. The coalition of providers that have expressed their concern, particularly from the higher cost to consumers and local governments and taxpayers, is...
Yeah, it's a heck of a coalition.
It is.
Another issue that I wanted to ask you about were, basically, I had a conversation with an emergency room doctor who was talking about the Cures database, and basically, I hear people rant about software and websites all the time, but this was really a scary rant, because he was saying that this legislation would require him to check this database before he could write a prescription, even for something like a painkiller for someone with a broken arm, and that if the database wasn't working or he got a denial of service error issue because, basically it was full or down or whatever, that he would be absolutely prohibited from writing any pain medication for that person.
The Cures database in principle is a great idea. A lot of folks are really concerned about access to powerful medications, opiate medications, and the effect that it has on society, and I think that's an important thing. But as he pointed out, the ability to provide for legitimate use of medications would be greatly impaired by that, because frankly, at this point, the Cures database is not robust enough, particularly if this measure passes, to take up the overwhelming amount of inquiries that would be coming in from providers throughout the state in order to meet the mandate as outlined in Proposition 46.
So it would be a replay of the disaster we saw when the federal Obamacare website rolled out and no one could get on it.
Absolutely, and much worse than that, there's no funding to increase security for that database, meaning that anybody and several people could get into that database and access privileged healthcare information of the patients that would have their information stored in that database.
So you're telling me this thing is easily hackable and everybody's information is going to be in it?
The security, the amount of increase in the security from what I've been told and what I've read isn't there. So... absolutely. It makes it much, much more dangerous in terms of people's personal privacy.
You know, I just saw a tweet from Eric Topol about some agencies that are selling people's diagnoses. For 19 cents, you can purchase the name of someone who has a diagnosis of erectile dysfunction so that you can spam their email. I see a whole industry here maybe coming into place. I wonder what kind of Pandora's box we're opening with this legislation.
Well, I think it's enormous. I think in this day and age, people are very concerned about their privacy. I don't think a day goes by that we don't read another story about various and sundry organizations, be it Target or governmental organizations, where people's privacy has been compromised. People, for nefarious reasons or for whatever reason, are able to get into those databases and use that information. It is a bit frightening from the perspective of, individual personal privacy of Californians.
Okay, well, I'm going to play devil's advocate for just a moment, because I did go into this Twitter sphere and look around at the Yes on 46 tweets, and they were all about patient safety, and we've got to, you know, this is going to help with patient safety. Is that a reasonable argument? There's a huge cost here. We've talked about the cost. Is there any benefit besides in the pockets of the trial lawyers? Is this likely to improve patient safety, do you think?
I think patient safety is a growing concern for a number of people, and I don't know a single physician or physician organization that I've ever encountered in my career that doesn't put patient safety first. It's what you live for. It's first do no harm. That's absolutely a driving principle of all healthcare providers, and physicians particularly. But this particular proposition isn't about that, and I don't think it addresses the patient safety issues adequately. Again, I go back to the point that I think the San Diego Union Tribune said it best when they talked about the fact that the way this has been worded and the way that the Attorney General has worded this particular proposition is in a way that uploads the drug and alcohol testing provisions of the law in favor of supplementing or suppressing the absolute goal of this proposition, that is increasing the cap on medical negligence in lawsuits and increasing frivolous lawsuits as a consequence of that. Well, I think the patient safety issues are certainly important, but I just don't feel, and I don't think several people feel, that this addresses that adequately. San Jose Mercury News in an editorial noted that they felt that there is no connection that they could find between the provisions in 46 and patient safety. And I think that's a fair assessment from their perspective.
Well, you know, once upon a time in a town called Troy, the invading army that had been holding them at siege disappeared and left behind this beautiful wooden horse. And the people of Troy thought it was a peace offering, but it turned out to be something else. And maybe that's what this legislation that is purporting to help with patient safety really is.
It would appear that to me, absolutely.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on and giving us a most articulate analysis of this. Thank you again, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, and I appreciate the time. Thank you.
We appreciate everything you do. Dr. Hernandez does a lot of work with no compensation with the California Medical Association and CMA, and it does a lot of work to help improve patient safety in this state. It's a very good organization. I'm proud to be a member. So we had a lot of good questions and emails this week. I'm going to start with one from Sybil in Switzerland. And Sybil writes, my doctor says that my optic nerve has a tendency not to get enough circulation, vasospasm. I don't have diabetes and I'm not pre-diabetic. As a kid, I always had unusually cold feet, and now as a 58-year-old adult, I am the kind of person who gets cold hands with loss of circulation in my fingers on a foggy morning in the middle of summer in Santa Cruz. I'm exercising vigorously 6 days a week for at least an hour, for example, running. The lack of circulation in my optic nerve has me worried. The eye doctor suggested taking Padma 28, a Tibetan remedy that is taken for poor circulation. The only thing I'm not sure about it is one herb that's in it, decamphor, 4 milligrams. I once read bad reviews about camphor, but could it have been the synthetic camphor of grandma's mothballs that is bad? The product also contains a bunch of other herbs. What else would you suggest doing or taking for poor circulation? Well, I have to take the fifth on the Padma 28th, the Fifth Amendment, meaning that I don't know enough information about those other herbs. I'm not comfortable advising people to take camphor orally at any dose. I've always thought of it as an external use, or at the worst, something you might want to inhale, but not something that you would want to put in your mouth. I'd be concerned about damage to the intestinal mucosa and increase in permeability. And we have so much permeability deficit right now leading to inflammatory bowel disease that I think we don't need one more thing there. And there are some herbs and things I would suggest. One of them is hawthorn, which can be obtained as an alcohol tincture. It's a berry from a tree, and it has a long use in American herbalism to improve circulation. And I believe so, as the extremities, so goes the retina in that respect. I also wanted to encourage you to avoid caffeine, which can have a vasoconstrictive effect and definitely worsens the tightening up of the peripheral blood vessels. Niacin, which is a B vitamin, can also be very helpful. Doses required to get vasodilation are different for different people, but you start out at about 100 milligrams three times a day with food, and then you work yourself up until you feel slightly flushed and tingling from the dose, and then you back off 100 milligrams. So you might find yourself taking 400 or 500 milligrams or 200 or 300 milligrams three times a day. You'll have to play with that dosing. Don't take the niacin if you have a tendency towards diabetes, however. You said you did not, but I want to put that out there for the rest of the clients who are listening, because niacin can worsen insulin resistance, so we don't want to go there. And finally, lowering your sympathetic tone through stress reduction. I'm one of those cold hand ladies myself, and I've always noticed that when I'm doing my drumming or my meditation or any of my relaxation work, that's the only time my hands feel really warm. When I get into typical medical practice, worrying about my patients, concerned about staying on time, that puts out enough adrenaline that I find myself washing my hands in warm water between patients on a regular basis, just so they don't suffer the consequences of my peripheral circulation. Hope that's been helpful, Sybil, and keep those cards and letters coming. We'll take one more email from Stephen before we go to the phones. And Stephen in Carmel writes, a 61-year-old friend of mine is a patient of yours, and he's told me you are comfortable with him taking small doses of melatonin nightly. I wondered if this would be appropriate for me at age 63 and someone who has regular sleep difficulty. My concern is that supplementing this brain chemical might reduce its natural production in my brain. And he has a second question, but I'm going to answer the first one. Stephen, I applaud you for thinking outside the box and actually letting that occur to you. Developing resistance to a drug or to a natural compound like a hormone can occur, part of a natural feedback loop safety system that exists in the body, and they're highly complex and highly variable. Melatonin is a hormone that goes through wide variations in the course of its normal output, and it is not controlled by the hypothalamic pituitary axis. It's actually controlled by the pineal gland. And so it does not show resistance when you take extra melatonin. That's probably because melatonin levels vary by as much as 15-fold from its low point to its high point in a given day. And so it's rather like epinephrine in that respect, in that we go from such low levels to such high levels. Our receptors have to be able to deal with that on a day-to-day basis. And so we don't have receptor down regulation the way we do with insulin, or a loss of stimulating hormone as we do with the things controlled by the pituitary, like your ovaries and your thyroid, where when you have high levels of the hormone in the system, the pituitary stops sending out the stimulating hormone. So with endocrinology, the devil is definitely in the details, but in this case, it's not a problem. And doses up to 20 milligrams a day are being used without any evidence of tachyphylaxis or resistance. I do want to emphasize that dosing on melatonin, what I like people to do best is take 2 or 3 milligrams of regular release, maybe even start with 1 milligram, and take it a couple of hours before you plan to fall asleep so that it has a chance to get through your digestive tract and be in your bloodstream. I also will use sublingual sprays of melatonin under the tongue for people who wake up at 3 in the morning and have trouble getting back to sleep, and I found that to be very, very helpful. Another product that I really like to recommend for insomnia is tryptophan. Doses on that about 250 to 300 milligrams seem to work very well. Stephen's second question was about a New York Times article that was very provocative. It was called, Should We All Take a Little Bit of Lithium? And it was in the 9/14/14 New York Times, and you can probably just find it by searching on lithium, but I will post the link because I thought it was an interesting article. It is about the fact that there's research, and it's been replicated several times, that shows that in areas where the concentration of lithium in the drinking water is high, there's a substantially lower risk of suicide, about half as many suicides in areas with high lithium than low lithium. The first such study, there were some studies in the 1970s. Then in the 1990s, a study looked at 27 Texas counties and discovered that there were much lower levels of suicide, homicide, and rape. And believe me, if we had a drug that would reduce the suicide, homicide, and rape level by 40% in a county, we would be putting it in the water. About 20 years later, a Japanese study looked at 18 municipalities with over a million inhabitants over 5 years and confirmed that inverse correlation with suicide and lithium content. And we're talking about lithium levels of about 0.17 milligrams per liter in the high places. That's way, way below the kind of levels of lithium that are used in psychiatric doses. So maybe it's a little bit like that orthomolecular B vitamin stuff with schizophrenia. There are, in fact, some people with schizophrenia who respond beautifully to high doses of B vitamins, and it clears up their psychosis. Maybe there is a substantial number of people in the population who aren't getting or require a little bit more lithium to have their head, you know, thoroughly screwed on tight. And if they get it in their water supply, that subgroup of people doesn't act on their pathology. It's possibly we should all be taking a little bit of lithium. Maybe we should put it in multivitamins. Certainly, the evidence here in this article call for more research. And there is data that was alluded to here about how lithium is known to be neuroprotective and is added to nerve cells in culture because it helps them survive. And the scientists like that when they're doing research on nerve cells. So thank you for bringing that to my attention. And let's talk now to Rosemary in Seaside. Hello, Rosemary. Welcome to the program.
Oh, I love listening to your program.
Oh, thank you.
I take anywhere from 2 to 4 200 milligrams of magnesium a day. And it's because
I'm sorry, 200 to 400, did you say?
200
okay.
Milligrams.
Yes,
and,
please continue.
And I take about 4 a day, up to 4 a day usually. The reason is that I think I have IBS, but with me it takes the form of constipation. And, of course, I do all the usual things that you're supposed to do, the high fiber and all that kind of stuff. But, I sometimes wonder, is that too much? Because I read somewhere that magnesium lowers your blood pressure, and my blood pressure is normal, but, I don't want to do anything that's detrimental. So.
Actually, most of us probably could stand to take 800 milligrams of magnesium a day.
Really?
Yeah, our soils are fairly depleted, and there are many people, particularly in the functional medicine world, that think that we should be taking at least as much magnesium as we take calcium as supplements to make up for the fact that we don't get a lot in our water or our food. Magnesium is very good for muscle cramps, and I generally will have people use doses up to 1,200 milligrams, and I have found it very effective also as a treatment for constipation. If you take too much magnesium all at once, it will give you the runs, because the body has its own built-in fail-safe mechanism, mm-hmm. and it just won't absorb it. And so you'll end up with, the milk of magnesia effect. With milk of magnesia and also a substance that you can buy in little green bottles as a bowel prep called magnesium citrate are forms of this that don't absorb readily and therefore make excellent laxatives. But if you're trying to get it into your bloodstream, I recommend using magnesium glycinate. That's a much better absorbed form, gets into the bloodstream. And also because of the glycine in that, which is an amino acid that is the, let's call it the precursor or the skeleton that our body uses to make GABA, which is our relaxation hormone. So you can actually get kind of a double good there. You get the magnesium for the muscle cramps and the constipation, and you get the relaxation. And if you give it intravenously, you can cause low blood pressure in people who have normal blood pressure. But in general, it is only really lowers blood pressure in people who have hypertension.
I see. Well, that's a good thing.
Yes, it is.
I'd like to ask you one more question, if I may.
Go ahead.
I had breast cancer 9 years ago, and in the last couple of years, I just haven't been having any mammograms. And actually, it wasn't a mammogram that discovered the breast cancer. I found a lump myself. So what do you think about, I'll be 77 next month. So, what do you think about, generally physical checkups and mammograms and things like that?
Well, I believe that the data suggests that up until the age of 80, and that's assuming standard lifespan. If you have relatives who live to 110, you might want to kick that up to 90. Allowing for a normal lifespan, typical lifespan of 85, up to the age of 80, there may be some benefit in mammograms, but it's very, very much tailing off after 70. And that just has to do with the fact that cancers which you get after 70 tend to be slower growing. They tend to not be as aggressive. So if the cancer is going to take 10 years to spread and you're not going to live 10 years, what's the point of finding it? And then you're fretful and having surgery. On the other hand, people who are at high risk, and a prior diagnosis of breast cancer does put you at a higher risk than the general population, of course, probably get more benefit because they have more opportunity to find cancers. So I guess the question to ask yourself before you get the mammogram is, if they found a small breast cancer, what would I do? Would I just have it removed and, go on with life? Or would I have it removed and do chemo and radiation? Would I be aggressive? Or would I just, just say, okay, I'm going to, I wouldn't treat. And if a person has dementia or a poor quality of life, we shouldn't be chasing preventative cancers in them. But it doesn't make sense to go doing mammograms on patients who are demented in nursing homes, for example.
I mean,
what are we doing? But you have to ask yourself, what would I do if it were positive? And if the answer is you would treat, then you should probably get the mammogram. And that's because of your prior history, I'm saying that.
That's a good way of looking at it. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for your advice, and thank you very much for your program.
I'm glad to be able to help. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our next caller is Sue from Santa Cruz. Hello, Sue. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Dawn.
Good morning.
I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about our public health response to the Ebola virus. I recently became aware that we all know it's very serious, but people infected doubles every 2 weeks, and that it's we haven't really done a whole lot to address it, and our world is so much smaller now because of international travel, and I don't know what we were thinking, and I'll take your comments off the air.
Can you clarify just a little bit when you say up from a public health level, are you talking about
what's being done
in Africa or what's being done here?
Well, because countries with strong government resources and strong government public health programs, they certainly knew that the African countries didn't have quite as robust public health programs to deal with it, but they didn't step in right away.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That helps a lot with the context.
Okay.
All right.
And thank you. I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay. One of the biggest challenges on the planet, actually, is Africa. And that has to do with a legacy of colonialism, with tribalism, with immature democracies and kind of strongman governments. It has to do with all of the current interference that is happening from countries and multinationals in Africa because of their curse. They have natural resources that more advanced industrial nations want, and they are easily messed with at the political and level, and so they remain a very chaotic and, for the most part, poorly organized continent. And it's a patchwork, and that's the biggest problem, is that if 9 out of 10 countries do it right and one country doesn't, then it's as if no one did it right. And we do face a major issue related to distrust of the government. People are unwilling to believe the public health information that they receive. I don't know, you know, whether the, you know, white faces in white coats would have any better luck at changing people's behavior. You're talking about some deep-seated cultural practices and paranoia about the government that is well-founded. So it's a recipe for disaster. And I think that we all have to take a deep breath and expect that, that there will be cases of Ebola that get to Africa, to America. There will be cases of Ebola that get elsewhere. Here, we do have the resources that we need to contain this kind of infection. We have good, we don't have burial practices, for example, that expose even the morticians to the disease. We don't have a good sanitation system, so body fluids are not going to be shared in the way that they potentially are shared in African countries. And so there will be potentially a few cases, but I don't think we'll see the kind of doubling and hot zone sort of phenomenon that is seen there, simply because this is not aerosolized. If we ever get an aerosolized aggressive agent out, that's a different story. But actually, with respect to its effects on in the more industrialized nations that have the infrastructure in place, I don't think we're looking at a serious risk. I do think that as a humanitarian move, we, not just for our own self-interest, but as a humanitarian move, massive amounts of resources should have gone in there. It's really funny when somebody, when there's a revolution and we want to back somebody, we seem to be able to get guns and boots in there pretty darn quickly. But when it's a public health crisis and it's just women, children, and families that are dying, somehow that doesn't seem to hit the top of the political agenda. And that's a true shame. So we have an email from Robert in Bonnie Doon. Would you please talk about the benefits of red palm oil? It's been suggested to me for overall brain health to take a tablespoon a day, but I'm worried about the saturated fat aspect. Well, Robert, I am kind of going to diss red palm oil on the basis of palm oil being a fairly substantial environmental issue. A lot of palm oil gets used in commercial products, and a whole lot of rainforest is being cut down to put up palm oil plantations. This is a very, very bad idea. So I would discourage making more of a market for a product that has such downside for the environment. However, coconut oil is just as good for the brain as are avocados. And a avocado a day or a equivalent amount, a tablespoon of coconut oil, would have the same benefits in terms of your brain neurotransmitters without having such a bad effect on your mom. That is to say, planet mom, someone we need to give a little bit more respect to. And let's go to this next email from Coral. Coral writes, this is regarding the man who called in first on 9/13/14. He was concerned about being dizzy and unbalanced, and you discussed several strategies regarding this, including stress reduction. Coral thought that perhaps what he had was a vestibular disorder. Symptoms worsen when the patient feels stress. But the detail he gave that made me think he had a vestibular problem was the difficulty he described on entering large stores. This is caused by visual distortions that accompany the neurological problems of vestibular central disorder, and it's so common that patients who have it typically refer to it as Costco syndrome. Well, I looked up Costco syndrome, but all I found on the web was people buying too many, buying things they didn't want to buy, they hadn't intended to buy at Costco. So I don't think I got to the right website. But fortunately for you, Coral did give us a very good website, www.vestibular.org, and also dizziness-and-balance.com. are both websites that give lots of information for people who feel dizzy and unbalanced. Maybe you have a vestibular disorder. Coral also wanted to put in a word for the Community Hospital of the Monterey Peninsula's Wellness Center Rehab and Physical Therapy Department that has two full-time vestibular therapists. And I want to thank you, Carol, for bringing this resource to my attention, because I was unaware of that. And I am definitely looking for some vestibular therapy for a couple of patients. So you have, with your email, I can tell you for sure, helped at least one severely disabled person possibly find the path to relief. So thank you very much. We had an email from Pat in Santa Cruz. What do you think of soy products? And she sent me a link. This was a link from realpharmacy.com, and it was basically a rehash of the usual, oh my God, about soy. Soy is an extremely complicated issue, and I've got it down to a few, to a sort of executive summary. So here it is. There are compounds in soy that prevent the absorption of certain minerals. They bind them and keep them in the gut. So if you're eating a lot of soy every day, you may potentially interfere with your absorption of things like iodine and zinc from your diet. This could be easily overcome by just taking a multivitamin pill that contained the minerals and doing that on an empty stomach. So not washing it down with soy milk, and you should be just fine. The second concern about soy is all of the very confusing research around breast cancer. There are some studies that look at soy in cell culture. Well, cell culture means that you're adding things in an artificial situation. And here's the key point. If a woman is making her own estrogen in her ovaries, then, or taking hormone replacement, then soy is probably good for her from the standpoint of stimulating the growth of nascent breast cancer. I want to emphasize there is no data that soy causes breast cancer. It may speed up the growth of breast cancer in tissue culture and in postmenopausal women with breast cancer who are not taking HRT. You see, in that group of women, their HRT receptors, their estrogen receptors are empty. And anything, even a weak stimulator of that receptor, like soy, will have a additive effect. On the contrary, when women have estrogen running around in their bloodstreams, the addition of soy probably reduces the number of receptors that are occupied by the strongly stimulating estrogen by blocking them or with the weakly stimulating soy. So the net effect is less estrogenic stimulation if you're making your own estrogen. It gets too complicated. You can't do that in a soundbite. Another thing, and the data is very strong on this, is that soy products in puberty are strongly protective for lifelong risk of breast cancer. So if you want to give soy milk to your tween, to your 10-year-old until she's 15 and her breasts are more or less developed, that would be an excellent idea. I would suggest fermented soy products. The proteins are much more accessible, and it takes care of this phytate problem, and it takes care of the tendency that soy has to maybe stimulate goiters. So, yeah, fermented soy and tofu, just fine. Lots of soy milk or a textured vegetable protein. By the way, the doses that would stimulate the growth of breast cancer, we're talking 4 8-ounce glasses of soy milk a day. I don't think that many people get that much unfiltered soy, but maybe I'm wrong. And certainly if you are a vegan and very soy-oriented, I suppose you could get there. So caveat eater to that group. This email from Kevin in Santa Cruz. Extremely low B vitamins at a cellular level. I just got back the Genova Diagnostics NutriEval test, and the results are described. I have plenty of B vitamins at the serum level. I have a great diet and take a B vitamin supplement. What do I do? Well, Kevin, I am very familiar with this Genova NutriEvaluation test, and it's what we call a functional test. So it looks at byproducts of B vitamin metabolism that should be low if your metabolism of B vitamins is adequate. Now, if it's not adequate, that could be because you have a methylation issue. In other words, a small non-lethal mutation in your DNA that changes the way your body handles B vitamins. The most common of these have to do with COMT, which is a methyltransferase enzyme and helps you get rid of estrogen and testosterone, and the MTHFR mutation, which has to do with how your body processes folate. The simplest thing to do in your circumstance would be to take a B12 sublingual dose that is methyl B12, or take methyl B12 shots. Now make sure they're giving you methylcobalamin and not cyanocobalamin, which is the one that most doctors use. So you'll have to make sure you get the methyl B12. But anyway, methyl B12 and methylfolate, doses of about 1,000 micrograms of each daily. And the B12, you might want to do sublingual or oral, probably would work for you. 15, that's 1.5 milligrams of biotin and 100 milligrams of all the other B vitamins, and maybe some trimethylglycine, which is betaine. Take all of that, about 500 milligrams. Take all of this stuff for about 2 months, and then get a repeat on the two tests, which are homocysteine and methylmalonic acid, that probably came back abnormal in you. And you can get those through Quest. You don't have to go back through Genova. And there is a code for this that will get it paid for by your insurance. So it's disorders of methylation. And have your doctor look it up on the internet. There's a code for that. And that will get the tests paid for through your regular insurance. So I hope that information helped. Well, quiet on the Western Front on calls today. Going to another email, this Anne in Santa Cruz. CoQ10, should it be taken as ubiquinone or ubiquinol? Also, how do you know if there's as much of the enzyme as it says on the label? Apparently, some companies make substandard pills. Can I take a blood test to see if the level rises after I take it? And if so, what should be tested and how soon should I see results? Okay, good questions all. First of all, CoQ10 is ubiquinone or ubiquinol. Actually, it's because it's so ubiquitous. It's found in all of your cells of your body, and it's critical to the functioning of your mitochondria. Statins lower CoQ10 levels in your system, and so that's one of the reasons that it's one of the reasons I recommend that everyone take extra CoQ10. Now, what to take? Well, take ubiquinol 200 milligrams a day if you're on a statin, 100 milligrams a day if you're not. And the reason I recommend ubiquinol is that it's better absorbed and more bioavailable once it is absorbed. So you can take a smaller dose. I would do a baseline blood test, and you can get a CoQ10 serum level, and then wait 3 to 4 weeks and get another set of levels. And ask for the red blood cell CoQ10 if you can get it from your local lab. But the serum level will work as a surrogate marker for intracellular levels. It's just not a direct intracellular measurement. You can find good sources of ubiquinol locally at many health food stores. And also, I believe Costco has a product called Q-Nol, which is ubiquinol, and that is also supposed to be readily absorbed. And at one point, I did go online and look at their data, and they had posted data that seemed very persuasive that they had a good product there. And we're rolling to Mardine in Ben Lomond. Hello, Mardine. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to talk to you again.
Yes, hello.
I'm calling because last week I was listening to a podcast, and someone called in with a question about fainting episodes. And I've had a similar thing happen recently. And your answer, you know, I wanted to see if it applied to my situation as well. In the last 9 months, I have had two times where I almost fainted, and you know, only didn't because I was with someone and they got me into a lying down position quickly, and you know, so I recovered fairly quickly. But I don't know the cause, and you know, it's kind of concerning because I've never fainted before in my life, so I'm wondering if there's something I should be investigating.
Okay. Well, how old are you?
52.
Did you have what was the almost faint? What did it feel like? Was there? Did you feel sweaty? Did you have kind of a brownish haze at the peripheral vision?
Yeah, I did get that. I felt really tired prior to it, mm-hmm. like half an hour before. I live in, you know, hilly area, so I was taking the dog for a walk, and I felt like I could barely make it up the hill. I was just dragging my feet, you know. And then when it happened, I was standing behind a chair looking over my husband's shoulder at the computer screen. So I was kind of, had my legs locked, probably. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was one thing that I thought, you know, might have been part of the cause. I had not eaten a whole lot, so my blood sugar level might have been a little bit low. And I, after the first time, I went and tested my blood pressure a few times, mm-hmm. And it was slightly low, not extremely, but it was consistently, you know, under normal.
What do you remember the number?
I haven't kept records of it actually. mm-hmm. I gotta find it, but.
Okay, so while you're looking for that, let me just say that when a person is exerting themselves and they feel faint, that is a huge red flag for some cardiac problem and needs to be investigated. There's no question about it. A faint when you are standing for a prolonged period of time, standing still, that can be just from that. People also will sometimes faint when they bear down, like if they're pooping. And sometimes even from people will faint when they urinate, but usually that's a recurrent thing and people know if that's their problem. But the emptying of a very full bladder rapidly can sometimes trigger the vagal reflex. All of these faints are due to the heartbeat suddenly slowing down a lot. And the heart rate stops and the blood vessels relax or slows down and the blood vessels relax. And that's a bad combination. Yeah. So you faint. And then as soon as you're horizontal, things are much, much better and you wake back up again right away. Sometimes feel a little tired the rest of the day. The fact that you felt extraordinarily tired before this happens and then somewhat afterwards, you know, 15 minutes later or so fainted, makes me think that you do need to do some kind of cardiac monitoring. And it may have been an SVT or it may have been an arrhythmia. Sometimes people's pacemakers or the wiring that transmits the pacemaker beat through the rest of the heart will just, you know, go down. And it's kind of like when you, about a year ago, I got a cell phone and it wouldn't charge with half of the chargers that were available and the other half would work. And it was obviously some little tiny tolerance thing in the plug or, you know, a crack in the chip or who knows what. But anyway, it was like, perfect. That cell phone got turned back in. And, you know, sometimes we get these mysterious sorts of electrical things in our heart that, you know, thank goodness we have technologies that work for them. But this is kind of how they present. And of course, it could be nothing, but you should get that checked out. What was the blood pressure? Did you find it?
Yeah, I did find it. 103 over 69, 115 over 65, 124 over 76, 123 over 76.
Okay. I don't think those are low enough in fact, those are happy, healthy blood pressures that I would have no problem with. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think you need to chase this down a little bit. You could get, this has just happened once, right?
It's happened twice. It happened once right before Christmas, and then just a couple days ago it happened again.
Yeah, I think probably what you want to do is get a 24-hour monitor, because a lot of times if you're having these, you'll have microscopic ones that you won't notice, but that will show up as irritability. And so the first step is just wear a 24-hour monitor. Then if that's clear and you have another event, you probably are going to have to carry a little card around. And the minute you start to feel exceptionally tired or like you're about to faint, slap the card on your chest, and the pickups will basically capture whatever is going on heartbeat-wise.
Huh. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, there's good technology now.
I actually felt for several weeks after the first time, I often felt like the beginning of it starting to happen, you know, when I was just sitting in a chair.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, you got to get this checked out.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to go to Simone in Monterey. Hello, Simone. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask about melasma and if there is any relationship with the increase of melasma with adrenal fatigue and other hormone or any other imbalances.
Sure. Melasma's
everything.
Yeah. Melasma's primarily going to be an issue from hormones. Estrogen is the primary driver of this unusual hyperpigmentation of the cheeks and face. And it is just about invariably a female problem. It's driven by, it's also driven by sun. So wearing very, very strong sunscreen helps reduce the stimulation to the melanin. Essentially, your melanocytes are hyperstimulated from the estrogen, and it is not associated to, at least to the extent that I understand it, with adrenal fatigue. In fact, one would almost expect it to be less in people with adrenal fatigue. It is associated with the condition called estrogen dominance, which is dysregulation where the ovaries just put out too much estrogen. It is a difficult problem to treat. We have some bleaching agents that we sometimes use, but for the most part, I don't like to use those because they are somewhat mutagenic, the stronger ones. The best thing to use that isn't going to cause any mutations is sunscreen and very strong zinc oxide or titanium oxide mineral sunscreens would be where to go. But it and hats and, of course, staying out of the sun. Sorry, I don't have better solutions for you. It is worthwhile to get serum hormone levels checked, however. This one from Randa. Pomegranate juice for Alzheimer's. I heard your statement about the scientist who recommends drinking 4 to 8 ounces of pomegranate juice, which has the chemical that he has shown in mice combats the amyloid plaques that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. This was from about 4 or 5 shows ago. My question is about heat. I found that everything is pasteurized except for one brand, which means heated. And she wants to know whether the heat would negate the effects of the chemical as it does with some proteins and enzymes. So I first wanted to say that pomegranate juice can be found in non-pasteurized forms, but I recommend actually using the pasteurized. And the heat for pasteurization doesn't usually distort the flavonoid molecule. It's harder. It'll denature proteins more readily. The pasteurization does affect the ellagic acid, and the ellagic acid is one of the things that has been thought of as a antioxidant. The compound that had the beneficial effect is a different compound. It's gallocatechin, and it's another term for it is a prodelphinidin. And these compounds and punicalin, which is in the peel, were the ones that had the most benefit against Alzheimer's in the study that I talked about. So what I do recommend, and I've started doing this, is scrubbing the peel and using a real pomegranate. Pomegranates are widely available, actually. Scrub the peel really well and just take a quarter of the pomegranate fruit and throw that in your smoothie and, you know, grind it up. And that's probably at the current state of the art, the best way to get the punicalin, which is what we think may have the benefit for and it worked by turning down the microglia inflammation, which we know that that is a key factor in the nerve cell death. So if we can reduce the inflammation and turn down the microglia, that really looked like it was targeted towards Alzheimer's. I think it's promising research, but I'm always trying to find a way to do the food. So if you were to look in my kitchen right now, you would find two pomegranates that I bought just the other day, and we're quartering those and going to throw them in the shakes. Well, we've come to an end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have, and I hope that you'll be joining me next week for more of your calls, letters, and articles in the news. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.